Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening and welcome to the program for Friday, May 29th, 2015, the Federal News Countdown. Features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. My guest this week, Frank Reeder, co-founder and director of the Center for Internet Security. It's great to see you, Frank. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And Jim Beaupre is the director of the ACT-IAC Academy. Jim, it's good to see you again, my friend. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's always good to be here.
You have each chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week as you see them, and we've got them linked later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we'll start on the countdown where we always do.
Number three.
Jim, your choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline's The Real Problem with Acquisition Training. And our friend Kim McCabe and Ann Laurent wrote this. It's been a couple of weeks now, but the issue with acquisition training doesn't go away. And as someone who is now in the training and education business, I imagine this is something you hear about all the time.
All the time. You know, the issue is we're still what training is available, because we've let so many acquisition people go, is that the training is the old traditional training. It doesn't take into account the fact that we're trying to acquire, you know, agile services and mobility issues. They're not being trained. One of the classes that we've put together, are in the middle of putting together, is how do you put cybersecurity into every acquisition? We've discovered that the contracting people, they don't understand what that means. Mm-hmm. They just don't understand what putting it in up front versus trying to patch it on the back end. Mm-hmm. And there's no training for that. So we're trying to put some together.
And our internet guru over here is giving us the big thumbs up because, I mean, you folks like you and Mark Foreman and others who were on the forefront of understanding the cybersecurity problem when the federal government first became aware of it, have been talking about that for years and years, Frank.
Music to my ears.
Yeah.
And if the acquisition people can assure that security is, as they say, baked in, the world changes.
The really disconcerting notion about what you're suggesting there, Jim, is that I've heard on a number of occasions the problem with traditional training is the style of the training, in that it's not the best choice for everybody anymore to sit in a room with 25 to 50 of their closest friends and have an instructor at the front of the room, and you do 3 hours and take a lunch break and then do three more hours and the day's over. But what it sounds like you're talking about vis-a-vis traditional training is the subject matter still the same as it was 10 years ago.
Right. I mean, you still need the FAR. You need to talk about the FAR. But what they don't do is enough experiential training where here's an example of how you acquire agile service. They don't do enough. That's one of the things that the academy that I lead, we focus on experiential training where here's an example. It's more workshop than training. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, some slides and stuff, but it's more focus on how do you do it? How do you bring it back to your office tomorrow? And I still don't see that going on in the federal government for some of the DAU classes and stuff. I still hear contracting people complain to me, well, you know, I learned about the FAR, but I don't know how to do an acquisition.
Mm-hmm. The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Jim Beaupre, The Real Problem with Acquisition Training from GovExec. Frank, your choice at number three this week is also from GovExec, and it's a synopsis, essentially, of the agencies that stand to lose the most under the Senate spending plan. The spending totals all across the government are laid out in this piece by Eric Katz. What'd you see here that made this noteworthy to you?
Well, what made it noteworthy is that is the focus we're putting on this as being a meaningful story at all. The numbers are not as consequential as the fact that we are once again doing the budget dance. Unfortunately, and I have to on the air voice a complaint, you stole my story yesterday in the piece that you did on behaving like adults about a budget.
Oh, the commentary.
Yeah. So I'm, you know, I'm on the record as lodging a complaint at our host. Unfortunately, he's spot on.
So you're in the unfortunate circumstance of having to agree with me.
Yeah, and
I'm very sorry about that.
You know how much that pains me. I mean, there are two issues here. One is, and you nailed it in your commentary, we know how to do this. Let's get on with it. But the larger point here is it's really inconsequential. The budget hawks, and this is not a comment to which one side or the other can claim a credit or blame, are focusing on the wrong question. The discretionary budget, which is what this describes, is 39% of federal spending. The real federal spending occurs through what are called permanent appropriations, things like Social Security, things that Jim and I love, Medicare, Medicaid, all the programs that are so-called entitlements. And if we're really going to have a serious budget conversation and talk about the macroeconomic impact of federal spending, that's where the conversation needs to occur. Clearly, there are legitimate differences on where the priorities ought to be for discretionary spending, the piece that this article is about, but that's really not where the budget conversation ought to be.
I'm reminded in this discussion, Jim, of the example of a household where the wife goes and uses 25-cent coupons to try to save money while they're hemorrhaging cash doing other behaviors, other places that would be very easy to stop.
I mean, I read your article yesterday, too, and I get just as frustrated because the budget discussion is never about the budget. It's a political discussion. Mm-hmm. And how do politics play into how money is allocated versus how can we save money? I get really upset when IT CIOs go, see, I'm going to save 10%. Well, what are you doing to take that and trying to find fraud and abuse? What are you doing to really make an impact on the budget? Mm-hmm. And as Frank said, 60% of the money is fixed. But they could work on that, but they don't. They work on these programs that are they're pretty much set by themselves. And I hate this argument every day. I read the other day, already the DOD has been warned we're going to be in another sequestration period.
Yeah, we have a story about that from its Government Accountability Office report. Yeah. And we have that up on federalnewsradio.com where they're saying, attention, DOD, sequester is coming because there's no remedy. So it's still the law of the land. And I know DOD is well aware of that. But it's that story's about collection of the best practices there because, Frank, we're going to be back in this same boat again unless something happens between now and September.
Exactly. We are, on the verge again of, although I don't think it's likely to occur for political reasons, hiccup government. But again, I think we're focusing on the wrong question.
Yeah. Frank's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec, agencies that stand to lose the most under the Senate spending plan. And you can find that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, Frank Reeder's choice and Jim Beaupre's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Frank Reeder and Jim Beaupre, and we're up to
number two.
And Jim, your choice is the second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is NSA starts to shut down mass spying program, and it will close Sunday unless somebody is able to figure out how to get Rand Paul essentially to be quiet. And I don't mean that disrespectfully toward him, because I don't know enough about all the issues involved here to decide whether he should shut up or not. But that's really what it boils down to. And there are tremendous implications here for the national security community.
I think there's real physical security issues. The NSA needs some right to do something. And if they don't do anything, they'll be able to do nothing. There's some place between doing nothing and the Patriot Act that let them do anything. Mm-hmm. But there's some place in between that our national security needs to be, we need to let our people know and find out what's going on. I mean, if this shuts down, I'm sure that we'll have another 9/11 in this country. I mean, just the capability that they have today has prevented so much, and people forget it. They think, well, they got lucky. They found the guy with the bomb in his underwear or this one or that one. But it's not lucky. It takes a lot of work, and those people work very hard at it. And if you take their weapons away, our physical security in this country will be at risk. That's what I believe.
The deadline is Sunday evening, and the Senate will return Sunday evening. It's unorthodox, but they'll do it to try to hit this deadline, Frank. As you watch all of this play out, Senator Paul got a lot of attention for a filibuster this week. Mm-hmm. What do we learn from the machinations in the Senate as far as how it applies to this program?
Well, it's a little bit of a replay of the previous item we talked about. I mean, in one sense, the Patriot Act was a result of, I would argue, an overreaction to 9/11. This is an overreaction to the Snowden revelations. The political system is inclined, for understandable reasons, to swing to the other side when something pushes it. My hope is that this actually results in a reasonable conversation about Section 15 and the Patriot Act, which some of us thought was an overreach, but certainly, like Jim, simply letting it expire and putting our heads in the sand is not the answer. So if we can, to be more using your example, get Mr. Paul off the floor, but instead have some wiser heads, and I think there are wiser heads, talk about what NSA authorities ought to be, rather than this all-or-nothing approach that we seem to be in.
And that's what I think, as I said, I don't claim to be an expert on the benefits and issues with this, but that's what struck me, is that I didn't see throughout any of this, not just in the past week or so, but throughout any of this conversation, I didn't hear anybody saying what Frank is suggesting, Jim, which is here's the one end, here's the other end. What's the middle ground where we could get a group of people that would agree? Right. Because it certainly appears to me from the outside that Senator Paul's position is this can't exist at all, and there's no middle ground. There's no compromise.
You know, we live in a society that it's a free society, but to maintain that freedom, we have to have certain knowledge about our enemies. And if we know nothing about our enemies, first of all, I believe they're all laughing at us right now, and we certainly have plenty of enemies in the world, that we need to have that in-between space. Okay, there's a compromise on both sides, and I don't know how they're going to do it on Sunday night. I really don't. I imagine it'll probably be something like sequestration. They'll vote on Sunday night, okay, continue the way we are for another 2 weeks or something, and it'll be like one of those scenes.
Is that what this could wind up looking like, do you think?
I would hope so. I have... it's a good thing I've not had to make my living predicting outcomes in the political system.
Well, and I know you're not suggesting that by hoping that that's the outcome that you think that's a good outcome, because I don't know that anybody thinks that's a good outcome. No. Even the people that are involved with this don't sound like they think that this is a good idea. Senate failed to agree on legislation, this story says, to renew the Patriot Act early Saturday. Senate Republicans said they'd come back May 31st, Sunday night, to try to hash out a last-minute deal, despite the White House and NSA warning that inaction would risk killing the program altogether. Senator Richard Burr, Republican from North Carolina, a fierce defender of NSA spying, said he believed it was merely a bluff. So there's still a level of maybe distrust is too strong a word between the two sides, and then I guess Senator Paul's position turns this into kind of a triangle instead of just one party versus the other. Right. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I mean, his position, you know, he gets in concrete and said, that's it. And, you know, he started the filibuster. We all love those. And it's not the right position. I don't care, because it's a do-nothing position. And, again, I sincerely believe the country will be at extreme risk.
The House already passed the USA Freedom Act, which would extend Patriot Act authorities but bar the NSA from indiscriminately collecting U.S. records in bulk. Instead, the agency would be able to ask the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA Court, for permission to obtain specific records from the phone companies. I mean,
that's a third party.
And there's the kind of the middle ground, it sounds to me like, at least, that the Senate hasn't yet
found. Down a marker, there's some question about whether the FISA court is a useful tribunal. This notion that it's a judicial process, but, oh, by the way, judicial processes depend on essentially confrontation. We have a prosecution and we have a defense. FISA court is a forum in which there is no defense. The other side isn't heard. So in the short term, this is a Band-Aid. I think we need to look at the operation of the FISA court. It's not a mechanism that I think addresses the legitimate civil liberties concerns that Americans should have.
And I think you're correct on all of those things, but it does seem like it moves us a little bit more toward a middle ground, which right now doesn't seem to exist in the Senate, at least.
And in that sense, I would certainly agree that this is a whole lot better than letting the authorities of the NSA expire completely.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Jim Beaupreis from NextGov. NSA starts to shut down mass spying program. Frank, your choice at number two this week is from the Washington Post. Hackers stole personal information from 104,000 taxpayers, the IRS says. And I had a sneaking suspicion when this story broke this week, knowing that you were going to be on the countdown, that this would show up on your list.
Yeah, I don't know why you would think that.
Not that you're into cyber or anything.
I'm not all, and not at all into cyber or privacy. It just there's an interesting aspect of this story that actually is getting better coverage today in some of the updates than the initial headline would suggest. I mean, clearly, in one sense, this was a breach of the IRS to the extent that people not authorized were getting access to, I think the IRS term for it, and I pulled out their press release today.
Get transcript.
Mm-hmm. But what this is actually the result of is breaches of other databases, which these presumably, well, they are criminals, these nefarious actors then used to gain legitimate access to the IRS. And in one sense, it's a good news story because the IRS caught it and was monitoring the patterns of use of Get Transcript to say, hey, wait a minute, we've got a level of activity and sources of the activities. I'm not operating on the basis of any inside information. Mm-hmm. What I infer from what I've read is they were smart enough to figure out that there was something going on here that was beyond what would be expected to be legitimate, even though the individual requests, because these folks had stolen personal information, were properly authorized. Mm-hmm. The short fix, which I think is unfortunate, but I think it's the only step that the IRS could have taken, is shutting down Get Transcript, which it has now done. Mm-hmm. That is not an answer. I mean, it's akin to saying we'll eventually wall up the bank and lock all the doors. Nobody can get in or out, but nothing can get stolen either. The challenge here, however, is the larger challenge of how we deal with breaches of personal data and the potential for identity theft without making it so difficult for individuals to do business, like do business with the IRS. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different model. We've generally looked at particularly federal personal data with a sort of zero defect, zero tolerance for loss mentality. In point of fact, the moment we open our doors, we have the potential for someone whom we do not like or whom we'd prefer not to have come in, walk in that door. So the question that this raises is, how do you do that? How do you keep the IRS running, which I think is doing a great job in making itself accessible while indemnifying people against potential loss? The IRS has notified those whose data they believe was breached. They are providing now credit protection for those individuals. And I think that's the proper response. The larger issue here is we all need to continue to be vigilant in small stuff, but that's not so small, like look at your credit report annually for each of the credit reporting agencies. Do all of the things that are necessary to watch for warning signs that somebody may have breached your data somewhere.
We'll talk about the broader question of accessibility versus security in a minute. But Jim, this strikes me, and I think it sounds like Frank agrees, this is a win for the concept of continuous diagnostics and mitigation. I mean, this is an example of the IRS noticing, instead of waiting for a report after the fact, noticing something kind of weird's going on here.
All right. There's a number of things about this story that bothered me, but one of them was that this went on for several months before they discovered it. So what's going on that information was being stolen and nobody knew about it? What's going on? What's missing from the system? Mm-hmm. Is it continuing, CDM, or is it some other monitoring capability that we don't have today? Turns out to be my number one story. And there were three things that made me have this as my number one story. 1 year ago, around 2000, I was doing some work for T. Rowe Price, and they saw internet security as not security locking down systems, but they viewed it for the first time that I realized in the right way was putting security in our systems allows us to deal with our customers so they can trust us.
Mm-hmm.
The second story was many years ago, I heard Vint Cerf, one of the real founders of the Internet, and he talked about the three things that we could realize the true capability of the Internet. And one of those was, until we are 100% sure that who we're talking to at the other end of that connection is the person, that we have that knowledge. And obviously, we're not there yet. We're long from it. And then the third thing was more recently that bothers me about that story. I went to, I think it was an AFSEA session, and there were three senior CIOs from agencies. I won't mention who, but three CISOs, three security people. And every one of them agreed that their systems are so complex. It was three senior federal security people saying their systems are so complex today, they can't be secure, which just knocked me back in my, because this was not a story for non-attribution. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were admitting that the systems are so complex that they can't provide the security anymore.
Is it too late to unwind systems that are that complex, Frank, or is that, what's the solution to that?
Is it too late to unwind them? Yes. But I think you named it. We do have a set of tools, including continuous diagnostic and mitigation. We no longer use the term continuous monitoring mm-hmm. because that gets us back into the Patriot Act conversation.
Right.
That allow system administrators, system owners to look at aberrational activity. This one is hard for the IRS. I mean, according to the story, they get 23 million requests for transcripts. So it's hard to see blips on a radar screen that is that cluttered.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think what we're talking about here, except in the case of the most sensitive systems that are either involve personal health or the nation's defenses, we've got to have some tolerance for risk. And we've got to mitigate the damage rather than think of this in terms of absolutely preventing any adverse event that could occur.
There are a couple of elements I want to explore in that risk tolerance discussion when we come back. The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Frank Reeder, is from the Washington Post. Hackers stole personal information from 104,000 taxpayers, according to the IRS. And you can find that story and all of our stories in the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jim Beaupre indicated his choice at number one is this story too, and we'll continue the conversation when we come back on Federal News Radio.
Search your term.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Frank Reeder and Jim Beaupre.
Number one.
Jim's choice at the top of the list this week is from federalnewsradio.com. It's my colleague Jared Serbu's story about the Internal Revenue Service's web app being shut down after 104,000 taxpayer information about 104,000 taxpayers was taken out of the IRS database. And that was Frank's choice also at number two, the Washington Post version of that story. You raised, Frank, an interesting point about the broader question here, and you framed it as what I wrote down as accessibility and user experience versus security. And Jim, that seems to me to be the ultimate balance that every agency has to strike that deals in any kind of PII with anybody, whether it's something internal or something external. You can make something as secure as you want it, and you can make it so secure that nobody will use it, and then there's no point in having it in the first place.
When we were off the air there, Frank brought up the point that the answer seems to be, as it was in this case, because it wasn't a cybersecurity incident, as it said.
Mm-hmm.
The people who stole the data had gotten the information, like passwords and everything, someplace else, and social security numbers, and used that to get into the information. So it was legitimate calls to the information, but the IRS didn't realize that the people on the other receiving end were not the real people. So that means the levels were not enough to keep people secure. So the answer is we lose our usability if we keep shutting down applications. There has to be some other way, some other means, because I believe the public is demanding more and more from our government. We keep on hearing, about the one shop coming into the government, so I don't have to go to the VA and register on 23 different websites to get my benefits.
Mm-hmm.
They all want a single incident. I think we're looking at a day where, like for my bank, I paid $25 and got my own cert. So when I do transactions with my bank, I bring up my little device and I get a new password every single time I access my bank.
Mm-hmm.
And we may get, it's very complex, you know, and normal users won't use it. But as life goes on, of course, the population is becoming more computer literate than they ever have been.
The NSIC program at NIST is one potential solution to this, Frank. Is that something that's, again, that the average citizen, we don't know what the final product will be from NSIC, but is that kind of solution the kind of thing that the average citizen's going to use? Because if they decide not to, they've made a choice themselves about their security.
Yeah, and your point about the average citizen is important because we've created an aura, and part of this is done as a consequence of the way the political system operates, that we should expect absolute perfection, that we have no tolerance for risk. Jim's example is a terrific one. It's user choice. I may choose to subject myself to the cost or inconvenience of using a device, a token, if you will, or I may choose to take the risk and say, you know, in point of fact, the moment I use my credit card, there's some probability that someone will scan it, you know, a server in a restaurant pass it to his or her buddy, and something will show up that I didn't buy, and while it's a nuisance, I accept that risk and the inconvenience associated with remedying that. The same is true of many of these public-facing services, that if we change our rhetoric and say, yes, it is really important for government to be trusted, and we need to show that we are continuing to be vigilant, as I think the IRS has in this instance. But at the same time, yes, by virtue of making these services more accessible, by moving to 24/7 government that doesn't require you to appear at an office between the hours of 10 and 2 halfway across town or maybe halfway across the state, we assume a level of risk. And I hate to use the phrase again, we need to treat the American public as adults and engage in conversations that allow for the possibility that everything won't be perfect all the time.
So there are three facets. Oh, go ahead, Jim.
I could see the time where, you know, when you go to a new website and they say, well, we'd like you to register for this, and you pick a username, mm-hmm. and then you put your password, and there's a little gauge telling you, that's not very secure, and the gauge goes up till it says, oh, yeah, that's a good password. Mm-hmm. I could see the day where you go to a government website and it says, well, you know, this is 70% secure, or it's 50% secure. You know, you'd have a gauge that says, well, how much risk do I put the risk on the user? So the user would say, well, this is locked down solid. NSA watches this site.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 100%. But, that'd be politically really difficult to do. But I could see that would help people a lot.
So there's three facets to the risk tolerance conversation here, I think. One facet is within an agency. What do we decide we want to expose ourselves to potentially? There's the risk tolerance that the user has to think of, the average citizen or whoever is using the service that the agency's providing. And then there's the politicians who are going to be overseeing and examining the risk. The sticky part of this, Frank, is they're usually the ones, I think more so than the average citizen, who demand zero defect.
Yeah, we talked about this again while we were offline. I recalled that my favorite case in point is the Social Security PEBAS system, where one story ran in the Detroit Free Press about the possibility that an individual's data might be breached in getting online access to pensions, earnings, and benefit estimates. As a result, Social Security, a spectacular, meaning lots of TV camera hearings, hearing was held within a couple of days, and Social Security shut it down. The consequence of that is individuals no longer had access, and Social Security now by law is required to mail you an annual statement I haven't costed it out, but it's perfectly silly since I will quote you, probably 95% or more of those end up in the trash can.
I think that's probably true.
In the classroom, I refer to that as reputational risk.
Mm-hmm.
And whether in the public sector, we call it political risk, but it, you know, someone will come after you if they think they can make political hay. Rather than fold each time that occurs, somebody's got to stand up and say, yes, Mr. or Madam Congressman or Senator, in fact, there is no zero tolerance. I love Jim's metaphor of the of allowing individuals to decide what level of protection. I don't know what you do, but I have perfectly silly, easy passwords for sites, for my access to sites where I don't care about the risk.
Mm-hmm.
I don't impose on myself the cost of trying to remember a complex password for something where, from my perspective, there's nothing at stake. At the same time, I'm prepared to take fairly elaborate measures to protect myself where the risk is high.
I have made a big change in all of my passwords. I've changed them all from password to password 123.
That's a big change.
I saw that on a list. I said password is the worst password, so I changed them to something else.
I
shouldn't have said that on the radio, should I?
I changed to a token for my bank transactions because I had used my ATM card during that Target incident with $23 million. And so I immediately called the bank and said, gee, during that time frame, I used my ATM at Target. The bank said, oh, don't worry about it. It'll be fine. A week later, they called me up and said, destroy your card. We have another one coming.
Yeah.
I said, okay, that's the last time I used my ATM card.
Not so fine after all. Most important federal news story of the week, according to Jim Beaupre, is from federalnewsradio.com. It's my colleague Jared Serbu's story. IRS shuts down web app after criminal network steals taxpayers' data. That story and all of our stories in the countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Frank Reeder. Wraps up the federal news countdown next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Not just the federal government level, certainly it applies in the federal level, but all over the country at all levels of government and the public sector, how there are consequences here that we don't always think of when we think of just budget issues or just size of workforce, those kinds of things.
Yeah, every time you invite me, I consider it a challenge to come up with something that you wouldn't have expected. I think I hit one on this. As I read this story, it occurred to me something that we don't talk about a lot, and that is what you might think of as the externalities of the budget process, the unintended consequences. And I don't know what Jim's experience is. Certainly in my life and among my colleagues, I've seen a lot of people for whom the opportunity to serve in government, to serve in the public sector, was in effect their path into the middle class, into the this vanishing economic stratum. At least that's what the rhetoric would have us believe. And while I'm not arguing that we should therefore start spending money willy-nilly to create jobs or use federal or government employment as a job creation program, we need to think about, and I don't think we do, the larger societal consequences of eliminating what for not the the. This article talks about black population, but essentially virtually all economically disadvantaged populations have, at least over the last half century, had public service as a pathway to a different and, I would argue, better life for themselves and for their families.
What do you see when you look at this one, Jim?
You know, this bothers me a whole lot. If you go back to the history of the country, you know, the black community or the economically challenged community, a lot was in the South in the early part of the 20th century. And what happened is Detroit started building and Cleveland and all those areas started building huge industries. And a lot of those people then got out of that by going to work for those jobs. And it was wonderful. And what happens to all those jobs? They're all out of this country. We don't have those hard industries anymore. So now the jobs are high technology jobs. So if you're economically challenged, and you haven't had the education, where are the jobs? What are you going to do? There's no more really hard labor jobs where you could go work in an industry and work your way up. So a good place is the public sector where you could work hard and make something of yourself. And those jobs are going away. They're just not there. I have a number of friends that say, well, I applied, but just the fact that I was a minority didn't mean anything because they had no job. It went away.
The demographic information here is striking. This story, and this is focused, the story in Miami, and a lot of the folks that are cited in this story work in various capacities for state, local governments, the school system in Florida. But the numbers here overall nationally, roughly one in five black adults works for the government, teaching school, delivering mail, driving buses, processing criminal justice, managing large staffs. This is according to Patricia Cohen in the New York Times. They're about 30% more likely to have a public sector job than non-Hispanic whites and twice as likely as Hispanics. And they quote Jennifer Laird from the University of Washington. Compared to the private sector, the public sector's offered black and female workers better pay, job stability, and more professional and managerial opportunities. Of course, Frank, that doesn't happen if the jobs no longer exist.
Exactly. And the social consequences, I would argue, of that are significant. I would have preferred to have a nice, glib solution.
Mm-hmm.
This is wound up in the conversation we started with about the budget process. But we need to look at, just as we think about investments in infrastructure as an important dimension of public sector spending, we also need to think about the investments in human capital that we're making. Interesting. I mean, let's narrow it. Think about the social and economic consequences of our armed forces. The fact that that is a pathway for individuals who, and let's take it out of racial and ethnic context, who are educationally disadvantaged,
mm-hmm.
To learn skills, to learn trade. They also, by the way, as a result of, I think, some very good programs, then have a pathway to better education. They have a pathway to home ownership that wouldn't otherwise be available to them.
Mm-hmm.
We, interestingly enough, are perfectly prepared in the procurement process to use spending set-asides for small businesses to stimulate economic activity in that sector. But we don't talk about federal employment as another way of not simply subsidizing, but actually giving folks that first step on a path toward a better life than they could otherwise have achieved.
The argument to that point, I think, would be, and I think it's a fair one, it doesn't make sense necessarily to have public sector jobs just for the sake of having jobs to give to people. But the turn back on that, I think, is, again, among our friends in Congress, who year after year after year don't seem to be able or willing to take a look at everything that the federal government does. And we'll talk just specifically about the federal government here and have an adult conversation about, should the federal government still be doing that, or should they no longer do that? And then being able to formulate a workforce strategy for the next 15 to 20 to 50 years and really determining what the workforce needs are to execute whatever the things are that the government should still do. Then you can make an argument of what the composition of the workforce should look like and all of that. But until you really know what you should or shouldn't be doing, I think it's hard, Frank and Jim, to have a conversation like
about
this.
You know, I mean, I agree with Frank. The consequences, you know, maybe expressed themselves in Baltimore and St. Louis. You know, maybe, you know, there was more to it than, you know, you need to open up the cover and take a look what's underneath.
Mm-hmm.
But this situation is not going away. I ask myself every day, what happened to the $700 billion that we set aside for the economic funds? It's been quiet. There's been no scandal, but it was supposed to help build up our infrastructure, which generates jobs and all. And I haven't seen it. I roads are just as bad as they always were. Bridges are collapsing just as bad as they were.
Let me be very provocative. My good friends on Capitol Hill of both stripes are shameless for shamelessly advocate a weapon system program because of its economic consequences for their districts.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this exactly the same thing? This is a, and that may be perfectly legitimate.
Yes, it's exactly the same thing, mm-hmm. and you know exactly why. You're too smart, and you've been doing this too long, Frank. You know exactly why it doesn't fly, because the military's sexy, and the Department of fill in the blank, if it's not the Defense Department, isn't sexy.
Yep.
That's exactly why it is.
I think you're right.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Frank Reeder, is Public Sector Jobs Vanish, Hitting Blacks Hard. It's from the New York Times, and you can find it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Gentlemen, a terrific federal news countdown. Thank you all very much for doing it. Frank, it's great to see you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And diehard Washington Nationals fan. First place. Can you believe it? If we'd had this conversation 2 months ago, I bet you would have sat here for the whole hour with your hands or with your head in your hands because they were underwater and in about fourth place. And now you're just smiling like a clam all
curled
hour
up
long.
In bed.
I was crying every day.
and as well you should have because they look terrible. Jim Beaupre of the ACT IAC Academy, it's terrific to see you again, my friend.
Always
thanks for coming
Francis.
In. Excellent federal news countdown, and it's archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The federal news countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose.